Welcome to Movie Geek and Proud. This is Movie Club. Rule number one, always talk about Movie Club. Rule number two, tell your friends about Movie Club. Rule number three, have fun and don't be a hater. Rule number four, there will be spoilers. You've been warned. That lovely conversation you have after you and your movie buddies watch a film together, let's start that conversation. Hi, everyone. We are back with another new episode. I'm here with Noah to talk about today's movie, Pleasantville, from 1998. Noah, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. I'm glad you were able to join me for this one. I know we've been talking about this particular film for a long time. Yeah, there's something I just wanted to really do because I hadn't seen it in a while, and I noticed that we're coming close to their release date anniversary. It was on October 23rd, so it's kind of nice timing. I remember you really enjoying this movie. If I'm not mistaken, this is your favorite, right? I think you said once.
It is.
Yes. Okay, very good. So I have the right person here with me to review this. Why would you say this is like your favorite movie to date?
Well, I think this movie for me has kind of personal significance in my life. I grew up loving television, and particularly classic television. I loved I Love Lucy and the Dick Van Dyke Show and the Donna Reed Show and, you know, a lot of these kind of 50s, 60s sitcoms. I lived on Nick at Night as a kid, and so when this movie came out, I was first particularly interested in it because it has to do with 50 sitcoms, and I love all the kind of cheesiness of it and the, you know, gosh, mom, and that kind of thing. But at the same time, this movie came out when I was 15, and I was sort of starting to struggle with my sexual orientation. I was realizing that I was gay, and I... at the time, still kind of felt like, well, maybe I can ignore it and marry a woman and have two kids and have that kind of 50s sitcom life that I sort of grew up wanting. And when this movie came out, it was, it sort of showed me that you need to live your life authentically and you need to be your true self, regardless of what society says you should be or should do. So this movie kind of came out at the perfect time. It was, I highly identified with Tobey Maguire's character. It just kind of meant a lot to me in that regard.
Very good. And for me, I only saw it the one time that it was in theaters. I remember what stood out to me was towards the third act of the film, there was this sort of big sort of pushback on anything different and using the word colored. So like that stuff kind of stood out for me as more of like a race issue, other than like just a, you know, just the theme of, like you said, just, you know, being yourself, not being afraid of change. Don't fear like something's inside you that's different or going after something that isn't sort of cookie cutter or the way that other people have planned for you, things like that. I barely had any memories of this movie other than those like small aspects that I remember from watching in the theater. So I just remember it getting, you know, super heavy and different from in the trailer, which seemed to have a bit of light drama in it. But I thought it was going to be done in a more sort of subtle way instead of just this hardcore, like really heavy pushback. And again, we'll talk about some of those scenes, but it was interesting to watch it this time in the world that we have today. And also just me being different from when I watched it back in 98, I wasn't even out. And I don't even remember even thinking about me being gay or, you know, super different and whatnot. So that stuff didn't really click to me as it did on this second watch. I don't mean this pun, but I mean, it was actually a very pleasant film to watch. I don't know, like watching it from the beginning, I was laughing more than I thought I was. This movie was actually pretty funny. And I think it was because of the heavy cliches that we saw that you are used to from these old you know, black and white sitcoms from back in the day, and just how any sign of different just would throw their world out of whack. And so I also enjoyed like the rules and things that were created, you know, on this transition from, you know, being black and white and then metaphorically and visually turning color and different. What did you think about your rewatch today?
I thought, because it had been a few years since I had seen it, I thought the movie took on new significance now for a couple of reasons. Number one, I saw a lot of correlations between the mayor of the town and Donald Trump. In fact, yes. There's even one line where he says, "We need to hold on to the values that made this place great."
Exactly.
Obviously very similar to Make America Great Again. Mm-hmm. So I saw a lot of connections there between the battle going on between the more traditional people as well as the people who were trying to change things within Pleasantville. And I think also the racial aspects / the lack of people of color was a lot more jarring to me this time around. I think that, you know, I don't think there is a single person of color in the entire film, which makes sense in the context of the 1950s sitcom. But even in the 90s world, there were no people of color. You know, the movie does refer to the people who turn into color as coloreds. There's a scene where a shopkeeper puts a sign in this window that says no coloreds, but they don't really directly address race in any way, nor do they directly address LGBT issues. You know, what's going on today with the protests and, you know, the anti-racism movement just ties in so directly with what's going on in this film. And that was much more apparent.
I do agree with what you said. I did notice all of those things, especially the J.T. Walsh, Donald Trump comparison, which, by the way, I believe this was one of J.T. Walsh's last films. He passed away just shortly before the premiere of this movie, so the film was dedicated to him. I just want to say, even though his character was, you know, kind of a horrible person, I really enjoyed J.T. Walsh's acting. I've seen him in other, you know, titles, and I think he's a really good actor. So just wanted to give a shout out to him. But yeah, sometimes you will see stories come out like in the last 4 or 5 years, and even sooner, and they will always have sometimes like a white person or Caucasian person tell sort of the struggle and story of somebody else's. I think Stonewall was another example of this, and they used a white central character to drive the story when clearly it had really nothing to do with them. It was more on the backs of like trans black women. And so in this movie, it kind of came off that way a little bit, is that we were obviously seeing, you know, Caucasian actors sort of tell the story of the oppressed, which is most likely opposite of them. But this movie also touched on sort of a little bit of women's rights, you know, just a place where a woman should be and artistic expression, things like that. So there were a lot of themes that kind of carried on through this. But I did want to start with sort of the beginning, and just like when they were going through the television and just seeing like the TV Guide channel and Dionne Warwick's Psychic Friends Network and all of that, it just really took me back to how old this movie is. It's so crazy. I wanted to talk about Don Knotts' character, because maybe you can shed a little light on sort of who he was, what his purpose was for this. Because I was trying to remember before starting the movie, exactly how did they end up in the TV and how like much fantasy is in this. And so he shows up immediately when the remote breaks and then was going to give him a full on replacement, but then hesitates and decides to give him the other remote, which will transport you in the show. And I think what triggered it was the fact that David, Tobey Maguire's character, knew a lot about the show. So do you have like a significance as to why that happened? Like why he chose? Because he kept saying, "I've been looking for someone like you. And, you know, I thought you'd be able to do this or something. I didn't understand. What do you think his reasoning was for that?
Well, before I address that, I want to go back to what you said earlier about the TV. And I wanted to particularly talk about the TV Time promo, which was very like Nick at Night, TV Land. They did a great job of kind of exactly replicating what would have been on Nick at Night. And when I was a kid, I loved that. I would watch that over and over again. I memorized that whole trailer, like lots of great stuff in nothing but black and white. and so anyway, I just wanted to address that because you brought that up. But yeah. To go back to Don Knotts' character, I mean, I think he was a god figure in this movie. There are a lot of questions that they really don't address and they don't try to address. And so as to why he put them in, you know, why he gave them this particular remote control, I don't exactly know. I mean, obviously, Tobey Maguire's character was very into this TV show and was able to answer all those trivia questions for the very best in men's attire, head right down to McIntyre. So, you know, I think it sounded like he was looking for someone that he could put in the show, but why he did that exactly, they don't really say. I mean, I think that's one thing that I found interesting again upon rewatching is there are so many things that they don't really say why something happened or explain it, or it just is, you know, like they never, you know, not to completely jump ahead to the end of the movie, but
no,
you know,
no, go ahead.
They never address like how Reese Witherspoon stays in the sitcom and what happens to her in real life. And like, isn't somebody going to wonder where she went? I mean, they don't really answer any of those questions. And I think that's okay. I think they're just trying to tell a story and
yeah.
But I think Don Knotts, I mean, I loved also seeing him in this movie because he is such a sitcom classic. The part was actually originally written for Dick Van Dyke.
Oh, that would have been a good one.
I don't know why Dick Van Dyke, why it wasn't him, if he turned it down or what, but it was originally written for him. In fact, they used his name in the original screenplay. They said Dick Van Dyke knocks on the door, but they had Don Knotts, and I think he did a great job, and it was a nice kind of wink back to, you know, the classic black and white sitcoms, because he is a lovable figure, and yet I like the scene in which he gets angry at David and he's in the TV store, and he's kind of yelling at David, and you sort of see this other side, but then at the end of the movie he comes back around and he smiles as he drives away and showing that all is well. And so I really liked his character.
Yeah, so do I. I thought that was really good casting to have someone from that era of television to come in and just be sort of this overhaul, like, guardian to this Pleasantville town. And yeah, again, Dick Van Dyke would have been a great choice. I did kind of see him as some sort of guardian angel over the town. And I don't know if this was his first attempt or maybe he's done it before, but maybe trying to recruit more people into the town, those who traditionally love those values and want them to kind of stay in sort of, you know, continuity. And so it's like, oh, he actually respects what this show represents. Let's put more of these people into that world. And it's like, whoa, you're even correcting me on some trivia. You'll definitely love this. But then you come in with your different ideals and morals and change everything around. This is not how it's supposed to be. I didn't really see him as a villain or anything like that, but I did see somewhat of him trying to like bring more people who liked those, you know, traditional values to continue. Yeah, I liked his character a lot too. Is there a TV show that you think you would feel comfortable blending in and being stuck in to without, you know, ruffle any feathers? Like, is there a show that you know very well that you can easily blend into?
I think that there are a lot of TV shows that I could, but I don't think I would want to, because I mean, as this movie shows, like, you know, getting sucked into your favorite TV show might seem like a dream come true, you know, like, oh my gosh, I would love to be a Brady kid, or, you know, I would love to work with Mary Richards at WJM. But so, I mean, I certainly know enough TV trivia and everything that I, you know, like if I were to get sucked into the Brady Bunch, I would, you know, I would not screw up the whole world because I know every episode and I know every plot line and blah, blah, blah. But I would never actually want to do that because I think the whole message of this movie is that the real world is so much better and wonderful and brighter and than any kind of TV sitcom. And so, you know, I could, but I wouldn't want to.
Yeah. I was trying to think of one too, and the closest that I came to is Family Manners, because that show seemed pretty, you know, safe to just kind of be in Chicago and be black and, you know, have a, you know, a wife and two kid family and everybody's all, you know, happy and together and supportive of each other and things like that. But then it was a little less out of the nuclear family sitcom ways and a little bit more modern as far as 90s was. So that would probably be the closest, but yeah, I wouldn't really want to be stuck in a particular TV show as well. I think I know enough of that show to feel comfortable sort of blending in with everyone, but yeah, that would be, it's good to just watch and not be in it. But that's the thing about like Toby's character, David, like I got a sense that he was sort of used to the way things were in his world, and not to say that he wanted to change things. He just sort of accepted his own fate, that there wasn't more to him than just, you know, what he was. You know, he's talking to his green dream girl, but from afar, you know, he feels that he isn't the type of guy that can go up to her and talk to her. And, you know, he knows his place in, you know, the world that he lives in. But then he really appreciates a show like this where everybody's like happy and wholesome and all of that stuff. What did you think about David's character?
Well, I related to David's character a lot because I think for him, like for me, I think there was a certain aspect of escapism in those early sitcoms and the idea of imagining what your life might be like if you had the perfect mom and the perfect dad and the perfect family and the perfect house. And I certainly didn't. Nobody does. That doesn't exist. It's a fantasy. But I think when you're a kid and you watch a TV show like that, I think it's very easy to imagine what your life would be like were you in that situation. And I think that's what David did. The scene at the beginning and then at the end with Jane Kaczmarek as his real life mom, who, you know, she's divorced, she's fighting with her ex-husband, she's going away with a younger man for the weekend, and he just like turns up the volume on the sitcom because he doesn't want to hear his mom arguing with his dad on the phone. So, you know, I think I can certainly relate to the idea of escapism through those shows. But like this movie demonstrates, that world is not nearly as perfect as it may seem.
Yeah. When they first arrive, they're, you know, they're getting used to their surroundings. And, you know, we have Reese Witherspoon, who plays Jennifer. Again, great casting on that. And she sort of plays this girl who, I guess, is, lack of a better word, like a very promiscuous person. Like, she uses sexuality to kind of not necessarily get what she wants, but she's comfortable, you know, with sex and just being able to just be that girl who appreciates, you know, being with the popular guy, sort of the things that you would find super important in high school, you know? You know, they didn't really talk too much about her character in the beginning. All that we knew is that she just wanted to date this guy and he was going to come over. But then we learn throughout the movie that she hasn't really challenged herself to really figure out exactly who she is and what she likes. And if it is different than what you're supposed to like as a high school girl, which is, you know, again, being popular and all of that stuff. I really enjoyed her character and her growth as I think she's like one of my favorite characters actually in the movie. She sort of had this very important role and part in turning this town. You know, she's the one that wants to play against the rules. And then all of a sudden she kind of just kind of goes into the background, and then we kind of see what she's up to here and there, but then it focuses more on Toby. I thought that she was going to be sort of the revolutionary person to get everybody to like be free and do whatever. She initiated it all, but then Toby just sort of took over and sort of drove it. But I really like her arc. There's a scene where she's like, why am I still black and white? Why am I not in color? And, you know, a part of me watching it earlier from that scene is, you know, usually when everyone has sex or opens their, you know, heart to like other feelings other than what they're supposed to feel, that's when you change. But it's not really that simple. And I think it's that when you turn color, you're actually challenging or actually letting yourself go and expressing some of the feelings that you didn't know you had. And for her, it wasn't the same route as everyone else. It was her challenging herself to be like, you know, I don't need to have sex to feel good or to get the guy. And she liked reading, you know, she was expressing different sides of herself that was always there. And I really enjoyed that messaging, but then also just that general fantasy rule in this Pleasantville town, that's how you change color, you know?
It would have been interesting to see what would have happened had David, Tobey Maguire's character, gone into this town without her, and if he would have just gotten kind of, you know, sucked into the Pleasantville world. But you're right that she is really the person who initiated all of this change. You need to kind of expand your horizons and not be who society is telling you you should be. And I think in her case, you know, in the beginning they show her with her friends and they're all just kind of mean to each other and they're all just going after boys. And I think that she was in this crowd where it wasn't seen as desirable to read books or be smart or, you know, so her kind of getting out of the promiscuous way of life was kind of her way of changing and expanding horizons.
I really enjoyed the curiosity of the town too. Just their face was just so lit up with wonder, you know, anytime they found something new or different that they didn't understand. And I really enjoyed that. I just thought that was fascinating, the way that they just lit up and just wanted to know everything, especially the scene where they're learning about Huck Finn and all the different books and like, you know, how did you know how to put out the fire? And oh, and that was actually a funny scene where he tried to get the fire department to help put out the burning tree, and cat was the word that gets them off their feet. Yeah,
which makes no sense at all. But again, it's one of the, like, it's called a fire station. It says fire department all over it. Like, I don't understand why they wouldn't know what a fire is, or why they wouldn't even respond when someone is yelling any word. But you know,
yeah,
it's a fun story. Yeah, no, and you mentioned the scene where they're all kind of in the soda shop and they're all kind of asking questions. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting was how that soda shop kind of went through at least three different like phases, where in the beginning it was kind of like, you know, like a 50s, you know, like, let's go to the hop, you know, like kind of soda shop, like soda jerk, kind of Johnny Rockets type of thing. And then a little bit later, it turns into a bit more of like a 50s greaser thing, where there's guys in leather jackets and they're doing the kind of like Fonzie or Grease, you know, Danny Zuko type thing. And then later it goes into kind of like a 1950s, like that scene. It goes into more of like a Beat Generation, intellectual, jazz, art, it turns into more of a, you know, kind of a Beat Generation vibe. But those are all different kind of either aspects or stereotypes of the 1950s. And I liked how they use that soda shop to kind of reflect different aspects of what actually happened in the 1950s. Because I think sometimes we have this view of the 1950s as it was all you know, Ozzie and Harriet Leave It to Beaver. But in real life, there was a lot more going on in the 1950s than those sitcoms reflected. And so I liked how they used the soda shop to kind of reflect the 50s as they actually were versus the 50s that we think of when we watch Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah. I unfortunately missed that era of television. I mean, I knew a little bit about them, like Donna Reed and, you know, like you said, Leave It to Beaver, My Three Sons, things like that. Those, yeah, for some reason, I kind of skipped that era. So it's good that you're on here to remind me of this, because, yeah, all of that I did not really know about.
I actually just, like, a week or two ago, watched an episode of Leave It to Beaver, which I hadn't seen in years. And I don't typically watch, I mean, I still watch things like I Love Lucy and Dick Van Dyke, but the more kind of family sitcom type things, I haven't really watched those in years. But it was interesting to kind of go back and watch an episode of Leave It to Beaver again recently. And this particular episode was interesting. And the reason why I watched it is because in this episode, Beaver befriends a child with divorced parents. And so this kid, his parents are divorced, and he gets lots of presents from both his mom and his dad. And it's a situation where his parents are sort of trying to buy his love. And Beaver starts wishing that his parents were divorced so that he could get so much stuff.
Get more presents.
But then he realizes that the boy is actually very sad inside because his parents are divorced. So it's also a way of TV saying that divorce is bad. You know, yeah. Like that was kind of the underlying message, that divorce is bad, which is, I don't believe is inherently true. I don't believe that divorce is inherently bad. But this is a good example of how those 1950s sitcoms taught a generation to believe certain things, and to that your life should be a certain way, and that, you know, parents should not get divorced. And if your parents get divorced, you're going to be really unhappy. It was an interesting episode to watch.
Yeah. Once things started to change and they were sort of challenging sort of the norm that was going on in town, it started to get a little dark in a way that, I don't know, there was just this sense of like, what is going to happen to this town if they don't do what they're supposed to do? It's like they've never really been taught or informed of any different way of doing things. And so it's like small stuff. Like when David tells Skip, Paul Walker, by the way, my God, I completely forgot he was in this movie. It was really cool to see him. But he tells him, he's like, I think Jennifer is, you know, I forget her name in the show. Reese Witherspoon's.
Jennifer Mary Sue, I think.
Mary Sue, yeah. You know, I think Mary Sue's a little different right now. I don't think she'll go out with you. And he, like, he didn't know what to do. He just went stoic, and his face just went, he just was like, what do I do with this information? It's like, she has to go out, you know? Like, nothing can change from this. But it's like, you know, Jeff Daniels' character, you know, the shopkeeper, like, he is just wiping down that counter until, like, the freaking, like, material comes off the table because he doesn't know what else to do. And, you know, even though it doesn't like literally come out like that here today, but it's just like, just imagine if somebody is so stuck in their ways, like they just wouldn't even have the sheer imagination to be like, well, I don't have to do it this way or in this order or, you know, things like that. But it was just funny how this town like just easily just kept going the way that they do. And one disruption could turn this town into what we ended up seeing towards the end of the movie. And it's like, I know the message of the movie sort of depict the possibility of what could happen, but even in a town that's supposed to be super pleasant, they haven't really been given too much danger. Everyone's happy. And yet the minute you see change, it just goes into this heavy negative space where there's so much fear and they just don't know what to do. And then it turns into like looting and rioting. They're burning books. That actually made me really sad when I was watching this movie. I thought to myself, I was like, is there any room to be different? And if so, like, does it always have to go through this transition of so much hate and fight in order for it to, you know, blossom and like come through? And it's just like, you know, we may be at a point in our lives right now where you think like, oh, any possible change that could happen that we need to challenge is happening right now. And that's not going to be the case. There's still going to be so much evolution going forward where we're going to have to adapt to certain things. And do we have to go through this heavy battle against each other in order to get to a calm space? And yeah, that scene really made me sad to see, you know, just the destruction of the shop and, you know, Joan Allen, you know, how she gets picked on for expressing herself, you know, with her body and being in color. And what also made me sort of like sad happy was just that David stood up to the bullies, you know, and fought for her. And sometimes you don't really see that much in media where somebody is defending somebody that doesn't look like you, or that could be harming to yourself standing up to somebody. A lot of people just like to mind their own business and not really step in and fight what's right. And he did that. And yeah, it really made me a little emotional to kind of see all of that, especially from today.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the movie kind of reflects, you know, what has happened at different points in history, you know, particularly the 1960s, when people who are different, you know, women, people of color, the LGBTQ community, when they have stood up and tried to fight for their own rights or fight for a life that is different than what mainstream society has said you should be. And as a result, there have been, as you know, riots and book burnings and all different kinds of things that, you know, are the dominant society trying to keep people in their place or keep people, keep a certain kind of life necessarily, but a way that we think of, you know, and going back to the 1950s thing, like I said, the 1950s in real life were not the way they looked on a sitcom, you know? But even today, I think so many people think that that's how the 50s were. And that is this time where America was great and we need to make America great again. Not to get too political, but what makes America great is the diversity of our country and the freedom that people have to live their authentic lives.
Yeah, yeah. So I just want to give a shout out to the casting in this movie. I thought there were some wonderful actors in here, and also just a couple of like cameos that I now recognize more today that I was really surprised to see in this one. Jenny Lewis was one, even though she had that one small part. She was one of Reese's friends in the beginning. Marissa Ribisi, who shows up in the Brady Bunch movie that we reviewed together. And then Whitey, that's David Tom. He's the one that was in like Young the Restless and Stay Tuned that we also did together too. And then for those Buffy fans out there, Mark Blucas, who was the other basketball player that kind of stood out in the team other than Paul Walker. And then Danny Strong, who plays the kid who's like into the jukebox. He was the one shining the shoes in the barbershop to the mayor. He pops up here and there and whatnot. But yeah, he's noticeable on the Buffy TV show. I don't know if you noticed this, Noah, but anytime that Reese and Toby were doing a scene together, and sometimes they would like argue and disagree about what's going on and what they plan to do, Reese's character would always sort of argue, but then say David at the end of her sentence. And it really reminded me so much of Schitt's Creek, the way that Alexis talks to David.
Yeah.
That stood out to me a lot. Just she was saying his name quite a bit at the end of most of her sentencing. So I just thought that was funny. And I'm like, I wonder if he got that from Pleasantville. I doubt it, but it just really sounded just like Schitt's Creek. So from the beginning of the movie, a lot of the things were, again, very challenging of what they were doing. And anytime somebody got wind of like, ooh, you know, is there a town outside of Pleasantville? What do we do in Lover's Lane? There's rain and color. And then it would just kind of mess up sort of their environment. And I, one big thing that stood out is when Skip was telling everybody about what it's like to like make out and, you know, have an erection and all that stuff. And then everybody just suddenly misses the ball because everybody, you know, always throws the ball into the net when they're playing basketball. I thought that was funny. And then like even the scene when all the fathers and the husbands are in the bowling alley and they're just like, I came home. I said, honey, I'm home. And the lights are off and nobody was there and there was no dinner. And my wife burns my shirt, you know, with the ironing. And, you know, some of that is funny, but there is sort of this comedic way of doing it. And then it just sort of turns into this very dramatic, serious tone that speaks, you know, volumes about today. What do you think about that sort of tone transition into the movie? Was this something that you think people would be okay with and expect to see towards the end of the movie? Or not to say they should have kept it very lighthearted, but was it, did they write in a good story to like transition the way that they did?
I think so. I think it's, you know, that's one of the things that I think makes this film somewhat unique is that it does start off being more of a comedy than a drama. You know, when you first start watching it, you think, oh, this is funny. Ha ha. They get cats out of trees. And, you know, it's the weather is always 72 and it never rains. And look at that big breakfast. You know, it does start off very much as a comedy. And it does, I think, but what I like about that is it does almost kind of lure you in to the story as like a 1950 sitcom was. It's comforting. It's not challenging. It's funny. And then you get invested in these characters and you get invested in the story and it does take it to a deeper and darker place. But I think it might not have been as effective if it didn't start off with that comedy. Like if it was just, I mean, if it was straight comedy the whole way through, then it wouldn't have the message that it has. And if it was just deep drama the whole way through, I don't know that it would have made sense given this sitcom world. So the movie itself almost starts out as a sitcom, you know, but, you know, you talked about the men and the wife didn't cook dinner and things like that. And one of the things that I think the film did really well was they made William H. Macy's character, the father, likable and sympathetic throughout the movie, despite the fact that he was kind of on the wrong side. But you, I think you could still identify with him and identify with the idea of things are changing and he doesn't know how to handle this. Like, he loves his wife and his wife has left him. And that puts him in a very dark space. And so it makes the whole story a little bit more complex because it's not just saying everybody should do whatever they want and there's no repercussions because, you know, things change and things ultimately change for the better, but that left him worse off. And I think that relates to how society really works because when, you know, when things change and when, you know, people get more rights or whatever, obviously that's a good thing, but it does still, I think the movie still kind of shows the other side can still have feelings. The story is richer and more complex because it shows also the story of this man who frankly lost his wife. He lost his life. He liked the way things were and things can't go back. Ultimately, again, that is for the greater good. And so many people are much better off, but I like that they still kept that in so that it wasn't like the other side were just all boogeymen and all total racists. And they all, you know, were just evil. You know, the mayor was arguably evil and probably racist, but the dad was a likable, sympathetic character. And William H. Macy did a fantastic job playing that character and expressing his frustration with the way things were changing, but also his acceptance of the way things are changing in the end.
I agree with you with William H. Macy's character. He definitely did come off sympathetic. I never really saw him as a villain either. I mean, he was just a man who really didn't know any better. He's used to the traditional values that was given to him. And had he been told that there are different ways of doing things, you know, he probably could have expressed sort of his motivation to keep everything the same. You know, everything was fine before, so, you know, why rock the boat when everything is okay? You know, even turning the mare into color, and it wasn't necessarily like, oh, we, you know, we must stop him. It's just more of getting him to understand why everybody else is changing around him, and that it's nothing to be afraid of. It's not like we have to stop you and you need to, you know, you can be one of us. It's not like it's impossible for you. And that's the thing. Even him turning into color was him expressing his rage, you know, like it's okay to be angry. And that's the other thing too. So once you see that even your emotion is, it can be channeled into something good. Now you know that it's in you. Now you just need to learn like what it means to you and whatnot. So yeah, the other aspect of it, the ones, you know, trying to keep everything traditional was very complex. At the end of the day, you know, I do have more of an understanding that it is more fear driven than just this idea of like anybody different than traditional is wrong. I think it just comes from a lack of understanding. I really like that this film did challenge a lot of it. And it wasn't, you know, no pun intended, it wasn't just black and white. You know, there were some middle ground in there of understanding where the other side was coming from as well. This was my first sort of encounter with the actress Joan Allen, who I don't talk about as much, but she's one of my favorite actors of all times. I just find her to be so fascinating to watch, and just her conviction and her fear of being different. You know, that scene she has with David and being super scared to show her face to her husband. It was nice that David had this understanding, like, yes, it would be great if you can go out there and liberate yourself and just be happy with this change, but you need to transition this in your own way. And, you know, the whole makeup scene and kind of disguising it, you know, at the end of the day, it sucked. Like, you shouldn't have to do that. But at the same time, like, it was understandable why she was scared and she didn't understand what was happening. And then once she really embraced it, she stood up to her husband. And I just think her acting, expressing all of that, was so good. And I've been watching her closely ever since then. I just think she's a wonderful actress. So I fell in love with her in this movie. If I got anything from this movie, it was her.
Yeah, I mean, I think that she was fantastic in this movie as well. And I think that she really did an amazing job of expressing her initial confusion around what's going on, and then her being scared and, you know, but such tremendous growth. And I love that scene. David is putting the makeup on her because I think it's so vital to not only her character, but also his character.
Yes.
You know, he was at that time still thinking that the right thing to do is to cover it up, you know, like hide it. And let's literally cover up the change and make it seem like everything's okay. Like let's not rock the boat. And what I love is at, this is kind of like a tiny thing, but at the end of the movie, when he's talking to Jane Kaczmarek, he's wiping the makeup off of his real mom.
Because, yeah.
Like, she gets the mascara on her eyes, mm-hmm. and he's like wiping it off of her and telling her, like, you know, life isn't, like, she literally says, I'm 40 years old. It's not supposed to be this way. And he says, it's not supposed to be anything. And it's kind of this like full circle moment where in the beginning, you know, he's like telling his mom to cover everything up and literally putting makeup on her. And now at the end of the movie, he's like taking the makeup off of his real mom.
It's so crazy. So, of course, I thought, and this is going to be a little personal for those listening, you and I just had this conversation about what it is we're supposed to have at a certain age. And it doesn't necessarily have to be that way when you're like, if that was pretty eerie to like come across a conversation like that when we just sort of kind of went through that. And so, yeah, very relatable.
That's a big thing that I took from this movie. I mean, that's one of the reasons why this movie stood out to me when I was 15, because it taught me that life isn't supposed to look any way. Like, because I so grew up truly wanting to ignore the fact that I was gay And my plan, you know, and granted, I was 14, 15 years old. I didn't know anything. But my plan was, I'll hide it and I will get married and I will have two kids and I will go off to work and I will come home and I will say, honey, I'm home, and I'll hang up my coat by the door. And like, that's what I thought life should be. I thought that's what would make me happy. And this movie truly was one of the things that sort of made me realize, like, there is no way that life should be. Like, sitcoms were pieces of television entertainment that were written by writers in Los Angeles that were just trying to come up with a story to put on television to sell advertising for orange juice and cigarettes. You know, like, that's what sitcoms are. It is not something that we should be basing our life off of, or, you know, altering the course of our life because of Ozzie and Harriet. Like, that's ridiculous, you know?
Yeah.
But that's what people do. And this movie is one of those things. And this is why this movie means so much to me, is because it's one of those things that sort of helped me realize, like, I need to live my life the way I want to live it, and however, whatever that may look like. And it's not supposed to be any certain way.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. What do you think about this movie today? Like, is this something that you think, like, a younger generation could relate to? Do you think that it holds up for those who watched it back in 1998? How do you think this would translate today?
I think it still holds up very well. You know, I mentioned that this movie is very much from a straight white male perspective. You know, I do think it would be interesting. You know, I suspect that if it was made today, there would probably be, I would hope, a greater emphasis on including people of color in this film.
Yeah.
Because I do think that is reflective of the fact that this movie was made in the 90s. Otherwise, I think it still holds up. I think many of the themes that, you know, like we talked about, many of the themes in this movie are still things that we're dealing with today. There are little things that date the movie in the beginning and the end with it being the 90s. But overall, I think it holds up very well.
Yeah, I would agree. I didn't find myself bored or, you know, have it be super dated and be like, well, you know, this doesn't happen. So it's just like, I'm not going to believe the story that's going on. I think the themes definitely project well. What I would have sort of a problem with as far as recommending it to someone is the lack of diversity in the movie. Do we want this type of story being told by only white characters? And so to some people, it may not hit the mark with them, and they may find it a little bit insulting or, you know, not a story that is going to project the themes very clearly. But I was very entertained by it. I'm also wondering, do you think that it would work if they updated sort of the sitcom era? Like, what if the show was like the world of Funhouse or not Funhouse, Full House, or any of those shows that just depict this sort of middle ground of happy, sort of middle to upper class sort of thing? Like, would the theme still work with a show that more people would know today instead of going all the way back to like the 50s era, you know?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I suspect it, I don't know, maybe I'm biased because I did watch so much 50s and 60s television, yeah. But I suspect it wouldn't work as well because I think the 50s hold this particular place of nostalgia in our culture. And there is this, you know, because there is such this idea that, oh, every wife stayed home and was a housewife, and, you know, every family had, you know, two children and a dog and white picket fence. And that is something that I think our culture so strongly identifies with the 1950s. And I don't think the same is true of, say, the 1990s. I don't think we think of the 90s as being this like idyllic time. I mean, maybe we think of it as being better than today, but I think the 50s holds, and the whole black and white TV, Leave It to Beaver, Ozzie and Harriet thing, you know, that may not resonate as well with the younger generation. I don't know. They may not have ever seen those types of shows. In the 90s, a lot of people still had. When this movie came out, a lot of people were still very familiar with those. So you know, I don't know. I don't know if someone who is 15 years old today would even know. They may not even know what Ozzie and Harriet or Leave It to Beaver are.
Yeah, so, these type of ideals that was held, you know, in the 50s. So, I mean, I again, I still think the thing can come through. It just takes somebody who is a little bit more open-minded. And I think also, because a lot of people sometimes will reject black and white films in general. And yes, even though we know that eventually it will kind of turn into Technicolor, there's nothing wrong with watching a black and white film as well. You know, Wizard of Oz did the same thing. And, you know, we got that sort of monochrome color before we get it into Technicolor. And I think a movie like that can still be entertaining. So what would you rate the film today? Has it changed at all, watching it now?
I mean, just like I said, you know, the looking at kind of how the issues that are dealt with in the movie are still relevant today, 22 years later, and I'm sure they will still continue to be relevant 22 years from now. And then, of course, the lack of diversity that we talked about. But for the most part, I think it, you know, it's still very relevant.
I would probably give this movie a solid 4. I don't think there was a huge reason to have some of these plot holes filled in, because yes, that was not part of the movie. Me just enjoying a lot of the fantasy of it. I would love to know more about the background as to how this is all happening, especially with Don Knotts's character and, you know, what happens to Reese when she goes to Springfield. Is that the only other town other than Springfield, or has the world completely expanded in theirs? Little stuff like that. Even the ending, I was sort of like thinking a little bit too much about, like, she's sitting on the bench with her husband and then the camera pans over to her, but then it goes back into Jeff Daniels' character and it's just like, has time progressed and she decides to be with him, or is she having the same conversation with the both of them? What would that signify? Like, I was thinking about all of these sort of like rules and like what's happening. And you don't have to think that hard about it to enjoy this movie. I just think it's fun. So with that being said, like, it wasn't needed, but it would have been nice to have all of that. Didn't you love how in the classroom they were talking about the ozone layer? And they were like, when you reach your 30s, it's going to get even worse. And I'm like, wow, yeah. Did this movie know a lot?
But to go back to the fantasy element that you mentioned, I mean, so Gary Ross wrote and directed this movie, who also wrote the movie Big and the movie Dave, which are two movies that I really like as well. And both of those kind of incorporate some sort of fantasy. I mean, Big particularly incorporates fantasy in a way that makes no sense at all. Like, you can't just wake up one morning as an adult when you're a child, just like you can't get zapped into a 50s sitcom. And it's highly unlikely that you would ever accidentally become the president in Dave.
Yeah.
But I think he uses those kind of fantasy storytelling devices just to tell an interesting story with an interesting message, even though obviously those things can't really happen, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Can I mention one other thing that I really love about the movie is the music in this movie. The score is by Randy Newman, and it's fantastic. I have the whole score. I bought it on CD a long time ago, and I still listen to it today. But there's so much good music in this movie. The scene where they're driving to Lover's Lane and At Last by Etta James plays, and they're driving through and all the pink rose petals are falling. I love that. I love Fiona Apple's rendition of Across the Universe at the end of the movie. You know, I think there's so much great music in this movie, and it was... that was one of the, and I also, you know, I love TV theme songs, and I particularly enjoy the fake TV theme song for Pleasantville that Randy Newman wrote for this movie. That's a song that I still listen to all the time.
Yeah, no, you're right. The music was great. That was a great scene. I also liked, as the car was going down the road, that's when everything was sort of turning into color as they were driving. And great music. I thought too, and really captured sort of the 50s as, you know, as well. So very beautiful movie. And again, as the colors started to come out, just that mix of black and white with the color, I thought was pretty brilliant. I thought they did a really good job with that. I thought that was good.
And that scene in particular, with all the rose petals falling, and they're in black and white, but the rose petals are pink, and then they drive in and everything is in Technicolor. It's I love the, and I know that, you know, this was kind of before we had as much CGI technology as we do today. So, you know, I know it wasn't easy to do a lot of that stuff in back in the 90s. So I thought that was really great too.
No, very good. Very good. Well, I hope everyone enjoyed this look back on Pleasantville. Any of it sounds interesting to you, watch a trailer, check it out. It's on most streaming platforms. You do have to rent it, of course, without subscription to cable. But I was able to get it on Prime for $3. So it's a little cheaper than an average movie, which is usually $4 or $5. So check out the film if you like. Great cast. Noah, thank you for helping me review your favorite movie. Hopefully I reviewed it in a justice to your liking.
Yeah, thank you for
Of course. And remember, everyone, there are no such thing as guilty pleasures. You fuck those haters and you enjoy your taste. This is Movie Geek and Proud. See you later.